Have you heard about the new MagnaGrip Pro Nozzle? The MagnaGrip Pro Nozzle is the easiest, most advanced nozzle ever, protecting you from the dangers of diesel exhaust fumes. With its patented flex magnet technology, the Pro Nozzle easily attaches with one hand from a standing position, can snap on from any angle, and fits flush to the apparatus, saving a ton of space. And MagnaGrip is the only exhaust removal system that offers a true 100% seal. For free grant assistance and to learn more, go to MagnaGrip.com.
This fire engineering podcast is made possible by Tenkata Protective Fabrics. The global leader in flame-resistant fabrics, Tenkata Protective Fabrics enables millions of people worldwide to be great at what they do. Generations of industry professionals serving in the fire service, industrial, and military industries rely on Tenkata fabrics for safety, comfort, and confidence. From the harshest working conditions to the welcoming sight of home, Tenkata recognizes the people they're protecting are unique individuals whose lives extend beyond work. Supporting a world of evolving needs, Tenkata's innovations lead the way in user-centric design, technology, and sustainability around the globe. To learn more, please visit TenkataFabrics.com.
Good evening. Happy June 8th. My name is Steve Hamilton, and you are tuning into Scenes of Violence on Fire Engineering's Blog Talk Radio. It is 7:30 Eastern Standard Time. And unfortunately, there's a lot to talk about today. Unless you're living on a deserted island somewhere, you have paid very close attention to the incident in Buffalo, New York, in Uvalde, Texas, as well as some mass shootings that have occurred at states across the country. However, the Buffalo incident and the Uvalde incident have captured and garnered the greatest amount of attention to date. It's a sad and unfortunate tragedy, and where one could take a political stance that it could have been avoided through various different legislative means. That's not what we're here to talk about. Under most circumstances, that's not what we talk about on the show. Fire and EMS are tasked with response. And where we have a preventive arm in fire safety, we don't have a preventive arm when it comes to active shooter, ASHER-type events. What we need to do is prepare, respond, and recover, and that's our focus. So we won't be discussing politics, and I beg you, if you are a member of fire agency, EMS, or law enforcement, that you also do not take a stance, at least in your uniform and in representing your organization. That can't have good impacts. People are very divided on the issue, and taking a stance one way or another, whether it be your personal belief, is going to be damaging to your agency in the long run. So keep that stuff to yourself. Understand that regardless of whatever statutes are in place, whatever our legislators decide to do in response to these tragedies, the bell's going to go off. We're going to get on the truck. The radio's going to go squawk. We're going to get assigned to something. We're going to go. We're going to deal with whatever we come across when we get there. Politics associated with how or why that occurred, it's just not our business. And we shouldn't lend an ear to that. So that's my soapbox for that. But tonight we have two special guests. We have Chief Otto Gerards, retired. Congratulations, retirement, from Orange County, Florida Fire Rescue. And we have Nicole Castles, who was an NFPA staff liaison on NFPA 3000, the Active Shooter Hostile Event Response Program Standard. Thank you both for coming on the show this evening. Ladies first, Nicole, if you would, please introduce yourself and include a little bio of how you got to where you are and kind of what you do with NFPA as of today.
Hi, Steve. Thank you for having us. So as Steve said, my name is Nicole Castles, and I am one of the technical staff on NFPA. I'm on the Emergency Response and Responder Safety Team, and one of the documents that I oversee is NFPA 3000. I got here kind of a roundabout way. I've always worked in occupational safety and health, and I also was a volunteer firefighter for several years. But I'm very happy to be able to contribute and help the wonderful volunteers develop our standards.
Well, thank you. And volunteer firefighter where?
In Maryland.
Ooh, job town. The state of job town. Good deal.
I've heard it called
Thank
that.
You for your service.
Thank you for yours.
Chief, if you wouldn't mind, kind of introduce yourself and give us a little background on where you came from and where you are now.
All right, Steve, it's good to be with you again, and I'm just sorry that we're having to talk about the repeated incidents of, violent active shooter and hostile events that seem to be increasing in frequency, not decreasing as they should be. But my background started in South Florida with the city of Hialeah, where I did the first 23 years of my career there, the last 7 as fire chief. Then it took me to El Paso, Texas for 3.5 years as fire chief there. Then Orange County, Florida for 6.5 years. And during my tenure at Orange County, Florida is when the Pulse nightclub incident happened, and we were the largest mutual aid responders. And like many fire chiefs, when there's a significant incident, we really look to the after action and we ask ourselves, what could we be doing better? And that really precipitated getting a coalition together of the IFC, the IFF, the U.S. Fire Administration, and others to support putting into NFPA for the creation of the first ever active shooter standard. And if people will recall, the FBI had come out with a report, and it showed their first report on active shooter hostile events, and it showed that, in the first 7 years of that report, we were averaging about 6.8 incidents per year, and then it increased in the last 7 years to about 16.9, and as of 2020, we had 40 incidents per year, and certainly the last 2 incidents highlight the need for many of the provisions that are in the standard, and so I proposed the standard to NFPA. It was accepted, created in record time with a cross-functional team is how we called it. And that really was made up originally of 50 people from very diverse backgrounds representing all of public safety. And we can get into who was there, but that the unique thing about the committee is now it's almost 70 people. And the one question we would always ask ourselves in the early days was, who's here, who's not here that should be here because we wanted to get very broad perspective because we wanted it to be applicable to law enforcement, fire, EMS, and all the other stakeholders that are critical in making sure that the way we prepare, respond, and recover is a whole community approach because that is the only way that we're really going to overcome some of the challenges that communities across our nation and the world have been facing as a result.
And I can't laud you enough for taking on the extreme leadership challenge of trying to coordinate that consortium to pitch NFPA to create a standard. That's a huge undertaking, and I thank you for it. I started getting involved in the committee, I think, in 2017 as a pay-my-own-way individual, since it's open to the public. And then I became the DOD rep on the technical committee, and you're absolutely right. It is a, well, what was the term we coined? Alphabet soup of acronymed non-for-profits, acronymed agencies, everybody in stakeholder world that had anything to do with the preparation, response, and recovery from an event has been on the committee, and it's grown substantially. I think we've done amazing work with the provisional standard coming out 4 years ago, around this time, if I remember correctly, within a few months. And our last update was 2021. Nicole, do I have that right?
I believe that's correct.
Is it 2021?
Yes, it's the 2021 edition.
And now we wrapped up a few months ago, we wrapped up first draft revisions for the next iteration, and we're starting to plan and coordinate our second draft, which will occur sometime next year. What surprises me is with this great group of men and women representing so many different disciplines, and I think I didn't even know that this organization existed, but the Door and Lock Hardware Association, if I have that correctly, we had a representative from that. There, it's just a huge group of people, and I'm surprised that so many end users that would utilize the standard are not aware that the standard exists, or they've heard it, heard about it, but they haven't really looked into it. What's your chief? What's your take on that aspect of this?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that, you know, have maybe made it not as acceptable in all quarters. Some of the things that I hear when I go around and I talk about the standard is, well, you know, why should police accept something, you know, from, you know, the National Fire Protection Association when fire's in their name? And, you know, what I tell them is they have a tried and true process that spans 125 years of making over 300 standards, and the majority of those standards are not fire related. And they were, you know, they were the system that was available. It's a recognized system. And the fact of the matter is that technical committee was a balanced committee that had law enforcement, or has law enforcement from the federal, state, local levels. They have folks in the policy making, the decision making roles, as well as the troops on the ground. And then it's the same for fire, EMS that's represented, university systems, private concerns, EM. A lot of the people that are on the committee are families of victims of active shooters that have happened, and they are advocates. So while it hasn't been widely adopted, I think, you know, unfortunately, when you look at the adoption of codes and standards, they're really on the heels of tragedy. And that's really how NFPA got their start, with the Triangle waste factory back in the 1800s, you know. I think what we're going to see is it's going to be unacceptable not to follow the tenets of NFPA 3000 because it is the standard of care. And that's what they're going to be measured against. In fact, I was just a few weeks ago, I was in Massachusetts speaking to mostly law enforcement, but there was fire elements there. And Massachusetts, I believe, has the potential to lead the way in adopting the tenets of NFPA 3000. And that's what they're looking at. They're looking at, you know, adopting by reference many of the provisions within there. And the fact that we made it in a way that's scalable means it's available to every community and it accounts for the needs of law enforcement as well as EMS, as well as fire. Now people just have to look at it. And, you know, what I told the police officers, and this was weeks ago, that when we look at some of the tenants and where we can have the greatest impact is, you know, from law enforcement going and stopping the killing and then having access to the patient so we can stop the dying with those threat-based care methodologies that are outlined through TBTC that's within the standard, it's going to be an untenable position going forward for the standard to be out there and for people not to be using it and not to be considering its use.
Yeah, absolutely. So for Nicole, since we're, in the 126th year of NFPA, a statement from NFPA's mission statement is to help save lives and reduce loss with information, knowledge, and passion. And yes, the initial formation of NFPA was based largely in sprinklers and fire prevention code development to help save loss of life and loss of property from incidents involving fire. But Nicole, you working with NFPA, as the chief articulated, you're not just a fire code or standard entity. NFPA 70 is the National Electric Code, and where one could think or argue that that has a fire department nexus, it doesn't. It's used by electricians. It's a standard for electricians when they're wiring and installing things, and that's, yes, we have a vested interest in that because electricity causes fires, but that's not what the standard is for. So what's your take on NFPA's impression or the impression that NFPA is a fire service entity?
So I think that I've heard from a lot of people that is a common misconception. The National Fire Protection Association does sound like, that fire could be related to fire departments. But we actually got our name when we first started. The very first standard NFPA worked on was fire sprinklers and trying to create a uniform standard to ensure that all the connections fit together and that all of the different systems in use were evaluated to the same standard. And so that fire in our name is really more talking about building fire protection and life safety when we got started. And it has since evolved into several other areas, including the fire department. So I think that while NFPA certainly does have a lot of standards that are related to the fire service, I think our mission really is much more broad, and we really are trying to preserve life across the board.
Well, and your background in occupational safety and health is you see a lot of cross-referencing with NFPA standards regarding health and safety and life hazards that, yes, the fire department and EMS would have a vested interest as responders to said event, but the intent behind the standard is to not have an event.
And I think also just, you know, in any area where there is a need to improve life safety, anyone can submit a proposal to create their own standards. So it doesn't have to be limited even to the existing standards that we currently have. Anyone can submit those proposals on our website.
And that's a really important point, and we'll just get to it now. When NFPA creates a standard or they're revising a standard, which is traditionally on a 5-year cycle, Joe or Sally, whoever, they have an opportunity to go to NFPA's website, look at the standard, at least an electronic version, and provide input to the standard for the committee to take into consideration when they are revising the standard.
Exactly.
And we call that what is that period known as?
The public input period.
Right.
One of the really cool things about NFPA's process is that it is an open and consensus-based process. So literally any person in the world, with the exception of NFPA's staff members, can submit recommendations. You know, if you're reading our standard and either you notice something that you disagree with or you notice something that you think is out of date or you would like to add something new, each of our standards during the revision cycle, each standard is revised every 3 to 5 years. Each revision cycle begins with a public input period where anyone from anywhere in the world can submit any recommendations that they have, complaints, changes, additions, things you want to delete, really anything. And when that public input period closes, the technical committees will review every single one of those inputs, and then they will either accept them or make a few changes and accept them, or sometimes they won't accept them. But they do review carefully each and every one, and they discuss each and every one when they are revising their standards. And then after that, the first draft report will come out, and the public comment period will begin. So everyone has another chance to comment on the changes that the committee made at first draft. Then after that, and again, the committee reviews every single one very carefully. They discuss every single one. And then those decisions and those revisions will be entered into the second draft report, which will again be available for public review.
And in our iterations, I think the highest public input count, if I recall, weren't we close to like 900 public inputs that we had to go through?
So Otto might be able to speak more to the provisional standard in the current edition. I know the first draft for the next edition that we just completed back in March, it was under 100 public inputs.
Yeah, Chief, do you recall?
You're absolutely. Yeah, I do. In fact, when NFPA 3000 came out originally, it had the most applications for committee members in the history of NFPA. It had the most public input. I don't remember the exact number, but there was a lot of synergies in that initial iteration. And there was, you know, if you remember, there was part of our initial battle to get the standard put together was amongst the fire service itself, because there was different areas within the fire service that said, you know, we shouldn't be in this space. And one of the things that would happen each and every time we met, either during the meeting many times or immediately before or after, there was an incident that happened. And there was the incident in the church in Texas that killed over 20 people. And that's when some of the chiefs from smaller rural departments came and they said, it can happen anywhere. And that's when we really started moving forward. And, you know, if you recall in those initial stages, there was some very passionate discussions, but everybody came together very well, considering each other's viewpoints and created something that now is going into its third iteration. And the beauty of the NFPA process is that with each and every iteration of the standard or update, we get to refine, add to our knowledge base, really put out a document that is the standard of care, best practice within the industry, and that continues to happen with the people that serve. And just to be clear, I'm no longer on the technical committee because I'm not allowed to be on the technical committee because I have since taken the position of executive secretary of the Metropolitan Fire Chiefs Association, and I'm now an NFPA staff member as a result.
Well, we take your input regardless, because it's valued, especially as someone who responded and participated in such a big event at Pulse. And I think the word that was thrown around that I think is extraordinarily appropriate is cross-functional in reference to the standard. And whole community, cross-functional standard meant for a variety of audiences and disciplines that, again, stakeholders who would have a role in this. And I think, to your point, it became widely understood that where the fire service ought not be knee-deep involved in operations in a hot zone and with bullets flying, and I don't believe that is a difficult argument to project. Just like we wouldn't want law enforcement, and law enforcement wouldn't want to do it either, is to go into a fire, a structure fire, with gear and SCBA and be in that environment, because that's not what they're trained to do. That's not the mission that they're expected to serve. But as in most mass casualties, my coined phrase for that is the fire department carries bodies to the colored tarps. And where the nuances of that are different and change significantly, at the end of the day, that's a large portion of what we do and an important function, and we bring the most people to the table to do that critical task, but it's still a function. And because we have a role or an expectation, regardless of whether law enforcement cleared or secured or whatever nomenclature you attach to making the scene as safe as possible for fire and EMS to operate, where there's still an expectation of us to operate, and therefore we have a vested stake, and we need to be at the table. So I think that is hugely important. And for departments that are familiar with the standard, for departments that are not familiar with the standard, inviting your law enforcement counterpart to sit down and have a discussion regarding the standard, what it says in relation to law enforcement discipline, is a good first step in utilizing the standard and what it's designed to do for the response portion. What are both of your thoughts as far as that goes, as listeners who are attempting to figure out the way ahead and looking at the standard and trying to incorporate that within their community and their senior leadership of the agencies they're in? What ought they do?
Yeah,
and Chief, go ahead.
Yeah, so I think you hit on one of the key tenets of NFPA 3000, when we talk about having an integrated response, we're not saying that fire wants to run the show. In fact, we're saying the exact opposite. If we're going to give people the best chance at survival, this is certainly in the initial stages, this is a police event. However, there's going to be, you know, once police enter and stop the killing, then that's where you have to have the ability to get in quickly in that warm zone or in the indirect threat area and provide that life-saving care to, you know, those extremity injuries, those chest cavity in the box injuries, you know, through, you know, some of the threat-based care methodologies. And so we have a responsibility to do that and to practice getting into the warm zone. So in order to have a comprehensive response, it has to be a cohesive response again through all the entities, not just from the beginning of the scene to where it's mostly law enforcement to where the scene transitions to patient care and your MCI components that happen a little bit differently or a lot differently because you're doing a lot of the triage and treatment within the warm zone, setting up your casualty collection points, your ambulance exchange points. But it all has to be, and that's all done with force protection. So it's fire and police working together in order to give those folks the best chance at life. Now, you know, well, we talk about it in the terms of active shooter a lot of times, but, you know, one of the things that I like to think about is how are we addressing the active dying that's happening as a result of the shooting? Because if we don't get in there in a timely manner, then that active dying is going to turn into people that are unsolvable. And they, in many cases, if we get there and we have access because we have that coordinated response, because we've been training together, because we've adopted policies, because we know what each other is going to do, because we've coordinated with the hospitals, the facilities managers, the schools. And as you know, one of the key components is a planned recovery. So really all those components work in concert and in one ecosystem to really give our communities the best chance at recovering quickly rather than asking questions on why didn't we do it better. And really, you know, I don't think any community should be in a position to say we didn't do everything we can, knowing that this threat is out there. We didn't do everything we can to prepare, respond, and recover from these types of events.
Yeah, I think that's a nail on the head. And Nicole, the standard is naturally broken up into three phased modalities of preparation, response, and recovery. And I think Chief hit the response part pretty good. But as far as stakeholders beyond fire, EMS, and law enforcement, that those first responders, there are other agencies, groups, or even individuals that have the philanthropy ability that you want to introduce the standard to within your community, because we address that in the document to those individuals as well. Can you expand on that concept a little bit of what we're referencing when we say that?
Yeah, of course. So I think one of the points she touched on was a cohesive response and working together. I think it's very important to note that NFPA 3000 does not prescribe any specific tactics, so it's not telling any agency or any organization what they have to do or how they have to respond. It's really just a program development guide to help all of the responding agencies get on the same page and understand, you know, where each agency is going to be and how they're going to respond so that you can all respond together without getting in the way of each other or without hindering each other. And it's really just to enable communication and cooperation between everyone's specific teams. And within those teams, I think it's very easy to focus on the initial response and think that, you know, a cross-functional, multidisciplinary team needs to include fire, police, and EMS, because those are the people who are responding initially to the threat. But if you look at the full response, you know, from preparedness to response to recovery, that whole program there, there are a lot of other organizations involved, and that, again, is scalable and dependent on your specific community and your specific organizations that you respond with. But that can include anywhere from, you know, your emergency management to the Red Cross and other nonprofit organizations and aid organizations, local businesses, community emergency response teams, anyone in the community that would be responding to something like this. Your mental health professionals for recovery, people who are setting up those notification centers and assistance centers. So it really is a much bigger team than even I think of when I initially, you know, would think of who would be involved. So NFPA 3000 is really, again, just a program development guide to help all of those entities who would be involved in this type of response work together to plan how best to work together throughout it, including, you know, joint training and finding a common language and common response plan.
Well, and as you both mentioned or allude to scalability, I think the standard provides scalability beyond Asher and into natural disasters. So if you had tornadoes or a hurricane or some other natural event that caused mass casualty, mass damage, mass loss of property, the stakeholders that are going to be responding to that are virtually the exact same stakeholders that are going to be responding to an Asher event. It's just the focus of the mitigation of the threat, for lack of a better word, or to make the scene not as exigent and dealing with that aspect seems to get the greatest highlight. But the foundation of the standard, the concepts that are within it, is really all hazard, an all hazard concept and an all hazard approach, and a very good selling point, for lack of a better word, is that if we can get this right as a community, as a municipality or a jurisdiction, this is really the foundation to be able to get all kinds of all hazard type incidents or events under a common operating picture where we have that coordinated effort. And there's not a duplication of resources or a duplication of effort or a building or a warehouse filled with people who gave donations or an influx of monies that can't be utilized in the manner in which they were given because of legal aspects to how it was given. All of those things can be addressed in your Asher program. It's just getting the folks to the table that make the decisions, the senior executives of these agencies and organizations, to come to the table, put pen to paper, and produce a guide or a document within the program for personnel to follow. Is that do you guys agree with that?
Well, absolutely, and some of the things that you're talking about are foundational, right? So When you're talking about agencies working together in a cohesive manner, well, that's the incident command system, right? And, you know, part of the drawback there, or one of the aversions people have sometimes is, well, you know, well, we're expected to do a unified command. And, you know, in after action, after after action, after after action, unified command does not happen, which is a key coordinating piece. And we're not telling police, you know, that it has to be the first officer on scene or the second officer. What we're saying is that this needs to happen. It needs to happen in a timely manner for a coordinated, cohesive response. But as the AHJ decide how it's going to happen within your community, we understand that if we're going to stop the killing, officers need to go in. But if they're going in, they need to communicate where the shooter is, how many victims, what the resource needs are. So those are essential. And then as the incident transitions, the focus of the incident transitions to the victims. But it all has to happen under the auspices of a coordinated system. Now, you spoke about some of the recovery elements. Well, a lot of those recovery elements are in place within a lot of the comprehensive emergency management plans, but not for an ASHER incident. So it's almost like taking the elements that are unique to an ASHER and building a new annex, and many have done that. But it's putting all those pieces together because it is a very dynamic event that requires that cohesion. But again, it's scalable. And one of the things we haven't touched on yet, a lot of these things, when you said put pen to paper, a lot of these things can be done before the first shot is fired. And it's going to put communities in a much better position to respond. And one of the ways that we do that through NFPA 3000 is through risk assessment. Going through your communities, we do it on the fire side with our pre-fire plans. Now you're adding another layer onto our pre-fire plans to look at some of the security components. So now it's a cross-functional team that's going out and doing the risk assessment. Now you have the ability to know the structures that are the highest risk structures when it comes to ASHER, whether it's a very high risk, a medium risk, or a low risk, and really design your response or your deployment models based on the structures within your community or the risks that you have within your community. A good example is the after action from Las Vegas. Las Vegas did a really good job under very extreme circumstances, but some of the after action elements talked about setting up for special events. Are you pre-positioning your MCI trailers, your command trailers, for special events? These are all things that are really going to speed the recovery and really make your response much more effective if they're put into a program and everybody is on the same page.
Absolutely. I know Austin Fire Department with Lieutenant Russ Howard and Battalion Chief Damian McKeon, they have pioneered pre-staging RTF with Polaris ATVs, and they will pre-stage based on special events. They'll pre-stage to known areas where they have problems and problems with shootings, obviously, but problems with ingress and egress, like on 6th Street on a Friday. So they have recognized that, and they are doing that. And I think it's a wonderful example of utilizing information from multiple events that have occurred and being proactive with saying we're going to do everything that we can to make sure from a response aspect that doesn't happen here, or that we have a resource access problem here. So I think it's great that they do that. I know Charlotte Fire Department does that as well. So in that, or since we're talking about the standard, Nicole, maybe you can touch on the fact that, yes, you need to have a subscription to NFPA to print the standard. If you have the subscription that where you get the copies mailed to you for desk references and you pay for that, you can access this standard and it doesn't cost you a dime. Can you expand on that just a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. So first, I just want to clarify, no one can print NFPA standards anymore. We're shifting to a new digital platform and moving more of our standards to a more accessible platform. So as of 2020, no standards are available in PDF for anyone, members or not. Everything is available either on Link or NSCSS. However, there is also a free access version. So all of our standards, all of our codes, all of our documents are available for free online, the latest edition and all previous editions. If you go to just nfpa.org/the number that of the standard that you're looking for. So for this, it would be nfpa.org/3000. And then right up at the top of the screen, it'll give you that free access version. And it is in a pop-up window, so if you aren't able to see it, just adjust your pop-up blockers and it should show right up.
So I'll say it in a way that neither of you probably will. You don't really have an excuse to not look at the standard or be familiar with it. It is accessible. It is accessible for you to free. You can't blame budgets, can't blame, pay cuts, can't blame technology outside of if your computer breaks. You can access the standard, you can read it, you can digest it, you can understand it, you can share that website information with your brother, sister agencies. You can share that at with community leaders, with people from the Chamber of Commerce, with your council government, with your mayor, with whatever leaders you need to share it with in order to articulate how the standard ought to be digested and used within your community. There's no real excuse to not be able to be familiar with it. And I would hate for these incidents to increase in regularity. However, I think it's sad to say the reality is that it more than likely will. I don't think it's out of bounds to say that is a potential for this standard to be brought up during litigation and other proceedings where agencies may be held to task for the content that is within the standard. And that has happened before across the nation. I recall in 2002 in Lairdsville, New York, the assistant chief of training was criminally convicted for negligent homicide when the Proby firefighter was used as a live victim in a live burn. And the prosecution, which New York State is not an NFPA state, the prosecution brought up NFPA's live burn standard. And the defense argued, well, this is not an NFPA state, and therefore there's no expectation for the department to know that standard or follow it. The court agreed with the prosecution and referenced, and I'm paraphrasing this, when I say NFPA was that particular standard was articulating a best practice and an industry standard. and regardless to whether your state's adopted NFPA or not, it was a standard that should have been known and followed. And I would hate to, for any agency, regardless of proceedings, to learn about NFPA 3000 after they've had an incident and the actual contents therein, knowing that had they known that before, their incident may have turned out differently. I cringe at the thought that there's that's a possibility. So I just hope that the standard can be looked at with an objective set of glasses, from the standpoint of the stakeholder, and reach out to others within their municipality, within their jurisdiction, and say, hey, we need to dive into this. And I think we can talk. Can we talk about first draft changes that are in the works before the second draft meeting? Are we allowed to bring that up or not yet?
So I would just be cautious because things can still change. There are still several more editorial reviews and such to do before that first draft report is out. But, you know, as a committee member who was there and worked on it, you're certainly welcome to share your views and the general concepts that you'd like to share.
Well, I think one of the things in the standard it talks about in the annex or the explanatory material, which is basically the back of the book, bans in greater detail what the committee's intent was with what they put in the main body of the document. And those are annotated with an asterisk at the end of the chapter verse reference number. And in the back, you'll find that reference and that greater explanation. When talking about the development of an ASTRA program within the annex, it was suggested that this program is a heavy lift for an individual. And in order to ensure that stakeholders have a seat at the table and it's manageable, that the recommendation was to formulate a committee with representatives from those stakeholders. And there is a push for that aspect, that committee-based approach, to not be in the explanatory material, but rather be in the main body of the document as you will develop a committee, and not assign this to an individual or to an individual office to attempt to try to wrap your arms around the standard as a community. And as you said, there are layers and steps still before that actually becomes standard, but I sincerely hope that aspect of it remains for the general purpose of just being able to be a medium to approach these agencies and stakeholders and say, yeah, this is, you might look at this as a fire service standard, but it says that I gotta have a seat for you at this table, and here's your seat, and can we just sit down and talk about this? I really hope that becomes the way. Gives departments and agencies some ammunition, for lack of a better analogy, to get people to participate. We are approaching the magical 1 hour time frame, and I try very hard to keep our discussions within that 60-minute window. I have no doubt that the listeners of this live and those who will listen to it as an archived recording later would have very little problem listening to the two of you talk beyond that 60 minutes. However, I feel that most people don't want to hear me talk beyond 60 minutes. think we can wrap this up at this point. I will give the both of you an opportunity to wrap the show up with your thoughts, and you're welcome to articulate that in any way that you see fit. To what we talked about, to the standard, to our current challenges that we are facing with this uptick. Nicole, I'll let you start. The floor is yours.
Well, first of all, thank you for having us here. I think it's definitely a hard conversation to have, but it is important to talk about it, find a solution. I would like to quickly circle back to what we spoke about before about this is an open process. We value input. We rely on input from people all over the world. You don't need to be a technical committee member or associated with NFPA in any way, shape, or form to participate in the process. And so I would encourage you all to go and read that free access version. And the committee just finished up their first draft stage, and their first draft report should be posted at nfpa.org/3000-3000-next, by October 26th. Of 2022. And so once that report is posted, that opens the public comment period. So if you have any comments, if you have any suggestions, if you have any input for the committee at all, you have until January 4th of 2023 to submit it on that document information page at nfpa.org/3000next. And I would encourage everyone to participate. Yeah.
And January 4th is that's a magical date in history. It's when I was hatched and brought into the world. So, for those who are pushing the deadline, if you want to send me a present for my birthday, if you're dropping an input in on the very last minute, I won't say no in advance. Chief, what would you like to add? Before we wrap for the evening.
Well, you know, first of all, you know, certainly thank you for having us on a subject that, you know, all of us hope we wouldn't be talking about, but unfortunately this is a reality of our service right now. It's a reality of things that we need to deal with, just like anything else that we've confronted in public safety and the fire service. This is one of those things that we need to get efficient in our responses to active shooter by advocating, by adopting, by incorporating best practice. And it can't just be something that we do once or twice a year in order for us to be good and give people the best chance at survival. It has to be muscle memory. It has to be incorporated not as something we do, but part of who we are and part of the service that we provide. You know, the last thing any of us wants to see is an agency being brought to task for their inaction when there's a standard like NFPA 3000 that gives you all the information you need to have in order to provide for your community. We talked about lawsuits, and while they haven't been widespread, they're coming. And it's going to be unacceptable not to do the right thing for the right reasons for the people that need us most, which is our communities.
I think that is a very timely and an excellent point. At the end of the day, no matter what set of glasses you're wearing, no matter how you look at this, this is a partnership. No agency can meet the incident objectives of mitigating an active shooter event in a singular world. Fire can't get in, access patients, extract them, transfer them to EMS if that is your structure
for rapid transport unless law enforcement does their bit with neutralizing the threat and creating a space of relative safety or a relative expectation of not being another victim from this aggression. And we cannot do this response in a single agency vacuum. We require the partnerships of one another in order to mitigate this. And if the events of the last several weeks is not a wake-up call to agencies that have not taken that stance, I'm not really sure what else there could be or what other incidents need to occur for that wake-up call for you individually or for your agency. And all we're saying is that there's a document that will help you navigate this process. And it's a good document. And it was written by men and women who are passionate about the subject, who are subject matter experts in their lanes, and they put forth a great deal of time, effort, and energy to craft something that will give you a path. It's not perfect. Nothing ever is perfect. But it absolutely will set you on the right path for your jurisdiction if you look at it. And if you haven't, I implore you, go to the website that Nicole had mentioned, nfpa.org/3000, and look at the document. If anything from this spurs you to do that, then we've had a successful show this evening. God bless. Be safe. Look after one another. We need it now more than we ever have. And I it's sad to say that I think we're going to need each other more in the future. So lean on one another. Forget what kind of uniform you wear and just remember that we're all here to do the same job. We're here to serve the public that has that expectation of service from us. That's all we're going to have for Scenes of Violence this evening. Thank you for tuning in. For those of you listening on the recording, I appreciate your time. And we will see you in about 6 weeks. And hopefully we won't have another tragedy or major event hanging over us in the room. So be safe, God bless, and thanks for tuning in.